The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guests on Off the Shelf are John Etherton of Etherton & Associates and Tom Sisti. Tom is a senior director and chief legislative counsel at SAP America. And gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, come on. You got to be a little bit more enthusiastic like that. Did I scare you guys or something with that introduction?
It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, well, thank you, Tom.
Eager.
Right. Well, I actually am... looking forward to this conversation because I know you will bring much more energy than the introduction was to the show because it is obviously we got three procurement kind of geeky guys here today. So I think this should be a very entertaining show and lots of great information. And we're going to be focusing a lot on what's going on with potential acquisition reform. There's, you know, the NDAAs are both out there now, and there's a lot of provisions there dealing with acquisition and acquisition reform. And I put reform in quotes, I guess, as you'll hear from our experts here about what's really going on. And we'll talk a little bit about budget. We'll talk about better buying power 3.0 and maybe a little about OFPP's management initiatives out there right now with procurement. But first, John, I'm going to ask you to kick things off and really just, you know, you've been on this show before when we've talked about, you know, the current, you know, legislative cycle as an opportunity for potential acquisition reform. You said there's been more talk about it and focus on it among staffers and members of the Congress than in recent times. Can you just give us the lay of land again?
Sure. This all really started last year when the Armed Services Committee sent letters around and basically did an open solicitation for ideas for reforming the acquisition process. And they put some conditions. They had some questions. They wanted things in a certain format. It's my understanding they got back, in terms of numbers, in the hundreds or even the thousands of separate ideas that folks had sent in with various degrees of support and analysis. Folks have been looking at that material now since last summer and into the fall, and I think what we're seeing in this first installment of the authorization bills for FY16 are the desire to get moving on some of these things. I think people have a different time frame. If you look at the Senate, Senator McCain has said repeatedly that he is trying to get as much done in the next 2 years as possible, because control of the Senate is by no means clear after that point. And if the Democrats were to take back the majority, which is a very real possibility given the number of seats that are up on each side, Senator McCain would lose his chairmanship of the Armed Services Committee and would not even actually be the ranking member at that point. So he sees things relatively short term. Chairman Thornberry, on the other hand, is sort of looking at a longer-term agenda, and his view is that, as he stated, maybe 5 to 6 years will take for a lot of these things to really be worked. And so he's taking a more incremental approach and wants to understand the ramifications at each step of some of the things that they're putting out there. So I would say, based on that, if you looked at the contents of the both versions of the bill, which are now in the Thomas website, if you want to go and look at them, what you see, I think, in the Senate is probably a more ambitious sort of agenda that they have. A lot of the same issues are being treated in both bills, but so there's a lot there. I think on the Senate side, and you've got an interest in trying to settle the issue of the degree to which that the service chiefs should be involved in the major defense acquisition process, and they've come down very strongly in favor of basically putting the services back in charge, sort of a post-Goldwater-Nichols approach, with some caveats on that. There's a couple other things in the Senate bill dealing with commercial item acquisition that essentially I would characterize as very strongly reiterating the preference that Congress put in place in the 90s in favor of commercial item acquisition. And there are also a number of other interesting provisions in there that in the Senate bill, which would, I characterize them as sort of increasing the tools in the toolbox that the Department of Defense can use in engaging with the private sector, primarily in the non-traditional small business space, but also even in the traditional contractor space, to try to engage folks in pursuing innovation, rapid acquisition models, and things like that. A lot of that is also in the House bill in different forms, and there are sort of a number of different approaches between the two bills. There are actually, it's worthwhile at this point to actually line the two bills up side by side and map a comparison. They really are trying to address a lot of the same issues. I think everybody's involved in the same conversations around a lot of these things, and I think even some of that is present in Better Buying Power 3.0 coming from the Department of Defense. So I think the initial expectation going into this year was that we would see fairly robust legislative efforts coming out of the House and Senate. I would say that the Senate probably goes beyond the tactical, and they're really going for a more fundamental change relatively soon. So there's going to be a lot to talk about over the summer. The process itself is actually moving quite quickly for the authorization bill. The House has actually had their bill marked up. They've been on the floor, had amendments, and they're off the floor. So the House has basically spoken. It's my understanding that next week the Senate plans on bringing up their version of the defense authorization bill. It remains to be seen whether they can get the votes to approve a motion to proceed. But we could be moving at a much more rapid pace this year with the authorization process than we've seen in the past 3 or 4 years. So there's a lot to talk about, a lot of markers that have been placed in the language, and so it should be pretty interesting summer.
So, Tom, John mentioned these hundreds, if not thousands, of sort of ideas and recommendations and comments were received by the House Armed Services Committee when they asked for them. What does that sort of say to you? I mean, is there like this overwhelming thirst for new ideas, or is it like things are broken and we got to figure out how to fix them? Is that a consensus? Does that reflect that or not?
Well, I'm not sure if thousands of ideas represents a consensus, but
well,
I think
consensus that there's a something needs to be done.
I think that's a good generalization. Maybe a consensus around some things could be better. They're broken. Maybe a consensus that that it's fixable. I think what John has said really, what's behind what John has said is illustrative of the sense of urgency, at least that you see on the Senate side. There's just this recognition that DOD in particular needs access to commercial innovation. And I think you saw that in the Secretary's speech out at Stanford. He acknowledged that we need a stronger partnership with our colleagues in Silicon Valley. I think it also manifests just a recommitment to the goal of having the government not duplicate what's out in the commercial market, to have the government rely on streamlined processes in recognition of a different world environment. Back in the last major reform in the 90s, we had an environment where the supply chains were different, the market participation by DOD and the government generally was different. We now have a more distributed supply chain around the world. We have adversaries who have access to technologies that we have access to. So to the extent that we're encumbering the government in accessing those technologies for procedural reasons, I think some would argue we're putting ourselves at risk. And we're increasing our costs and all these other negative things. So I think that's sort of the unspoken thing behind the language that we're seeing. But you do have this sense that people are confronting different things in the system depending on how they approach the system. Do they approach it through GWACs? Are they suppliers to primes? Are they,
right.
Everybody has a perspective based on their market participation.
Right. And hence the perspective leads to thousands or hundreds of whatever of ideas and recommendations. We do have to just about take our first break already, guys. When we come back, we'll talk more about, in particular, the Senate's National Defense Authorization Act as currently drafted, talk about some of those key provisions. I also have a question for John is, if the philosophy is to give the services more control, it's hard enough for them to play together in the same sandbox as it is. Are we looking at a time when we potentially need more collaboration or leveraging of resources Is that counter that approach, or just, you know, what, how they, how is that dealt with? My guests today are John Etherton. He is president of Etherton and Associates, and Tom Sisti. Tom is a senior director and chief legislative counsel for SAP America. And you're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests today are Tom Sisti. Tom is the senior director and chief legislative counsel for SAP America, and John Etherton, who is president of Etherton and Associates. And guys, when we took the break, I mentioned getting a bit more specific. We set the table. We've talked about why we are where we are right now in terms of the focus on acquisition reform and what's going on the Hill and sort of in the markets. But now we get into some of the devils in the details, right? And what are some of these key proposals and ideas that are floating around out there? So, John, I'm going to turn it over for you. And first, could you, you know, I have a question at the end of the segment that we didn't have time to answer, but just this, to the extent the philosophical approach in the Senate bill is to give the services sort of more authority over the procurement decisions, I guess, and I'm paraphrasing, you know, at the same time you hear about the government needing to, you know, leverage its resources across the board, other services, like, you know, working together for on new weapon systems. Does this, how does that translate?
I don't think that they've really come out and done something that would be prejudicial against the idea of joint programs. But I think the idea that they're really looking for, and I think this is really key for Senator McCain, is accountability. I would say if there's one thing that Senator McCain has been more concerned about, as you sort of look at a number of different areas where he has had thoughts on acquisition policy, it's been in that area, that everything that he really seems to want to do really drives toward it, to having greater accountability in the process with individuals, with organizations. And so I see this really as an outcome of that, not so much against the concepts of jointness and programs. I think if you look at the language that's in the bill, what you see is basically a desire to move the basic authority and responsibility for major defense acquisition programs from the Office of the Secretary of Defense to the individual services, and to accomplish that transition by October of 2016. So it would have to happen relatively quickly. There's some changes to the charters of the service chiefs, which would make clear what the full scope of their responsibilities. And frankly, what they're really, the way I read the language, it really looks more in the area of requirements and making sort of the trade-off in those areas, not so much getting into issues such as, you know, what contract type should the program be using or anything like that. Although I know that's a concern that some of the officials in the Department have raised with some of these ideas. But again, I think the real measure here is accountability. And I think the idea that you have the service chiefs who are closer, I guess, to the user community, and that you can basically locate the decision-making on the trade-off side, not so much in sort of this vast process that involves a lot of different stakeholders with a lot of different responsibilities, but something where no matter what changes are made or what things are proposed, that you have a way of tracing it back to individuals making individual decisions. The other issue, I think there's a focus that's explicit in one of the provisions in the bill, and I don't recall what the number is in Title VIII, but basically it identifies the customer as part of the acquisition process, to basically say this is really how you build your requirements around the customer, that be basically the end user, the service with the mission requirement or whatever. And to clarify that in statute, I think combining that with this proposal to shift the focus of management responsibilities to the service chiefs, you know, I think both of those have to be seen in sort of conjunction. I don't know where we end up with this at the end of the summer, because I think that the House has taken a much more cautious approach. They've asked a lot of the same questions that I think led to the specific legislation in the Senate bill, but they were not quite ready to make the move to, they felt, you know, that they needed to get more information and have some further dialogue amongst all the stakeholders before they were ready to make a move in terms of a major shift of responsibilities. Although even in their bill, there is some clarifications around the acquisition responsibilities of the service chief that's in the language. So it's going to be an interesting conversation over the summer, I think, to sort of look at that and where the, is there a balance? Is there a way of sort of measuring the added value of the different stakeholders being involved to greater or lesser degrees, and what can be made compatible with the desire for greater accountability? So I think it's going to be an interesting conversation.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And Tom, with regard to the Senate NDAA, the focus on commercial acquisition, commercial items. Can you talk a little bit about that? And does it sort of, I think it's John, excuse me, you said earlier, it's kind of reaffirms, you know, prior sort of statements in terms of procurement approach?
Well, I think it's interesting that there we have the provisions that say that laws subsequently enacted are not applicable to commercial item acquisitions unless they're specifically determined in writing to be applicable to those acquisitions. I think that two things are attached to that. One, it's a linkage back to the 90s and the language of acquisition reform, FASA and Cleon-Cohen. And two, it's really a statement, perhaps that of concern. There's concern that we are over time layering on to those acquisitions in a reactive way and not necessarily in a thoughtful way. And this is to require some element of deliberation before applying all of these provisions to a process that was supposed to be streamlined. It was supposed to be commercial-like. So that the government could take advantage of all of the activities of the private sector and free up its resources to focus on those things that are military unique, if you will. I think you see it there.
And is there a provision? There's provision about, you know, the DFARS and what, you know, and to the extent you include DFARS clauses and commercial item contracts, mm-hmm. they have to be required by law, essentially, or an executive order?
Well, think about it. And along those lines, there's a provision that calls for requirements for market research that includes vetting with those familiar with the particular item that you're researching.
The customer.
Yeah. Right. It's a restatement, a reemphasis that you have to engage in active research for the determination of fair and reasonable pricing, that you don't want people developing checklists. And this kind of aligns with some who have talked about having our contracting officials exercise the discretion that they need to exercise and the ability to think relative to the set of requirements that are before them in making their contract decisions.
Right. You know, one point you made to it, and it seems to me to be right on point, is that this idea of layering on of additional requirements, especially in commercial item contracting, you see it not just in the department, but it's a government-wide phenomenon. And this to me is almost like, well, we passed commercial item contracting and FASA, right, created that authority, and we really meant it, right? And like it's 15 years later, or no, is it 20 years later, 21 years later, and you know, that whole idea and concept seems to be have withered or it's people ignore it. I mean, just the layering on. I mean, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that,
John. Well, we talk about
John?
Procurement Groundhog Day. You know,
right.
we're going to revisit the issues over and over again.
I think one of the issues, though, that you have to recognize is that the definition of commercial item is a very broad definition. And so there are a lot of things that would qualify as a commercial item that get this treatment. And that's you know, raised issues and concerns that I think have led to some of that. But I also think if you look at the Senate language, what you see is a somewhat nuanced approach in that they look at commercial items in different categories and treat them in different ways, which I think is also interesting. I think the other area that they came out fairly emphatically, and it's the same similar approach that's reflected in the House bill almost equally emphatically, and that is that the determination of a commerciality is a separate process and should be kept separate from the determination on price reasonableness, and that those are two separate issues and they ought to be treated as separate processes for purposes of, you know, decision making, which I think there had been some confusion around that point, and frankly the law in some ways had supported that. So I think some of what I see in both the House and Senate bill, there are basically what they're interested in is trying to figure out some way to get some clarity around some of these issues so that things can be a little more isolated and you know, we can proceed on that basis.
But I just want to add, I don't think it's simply a restatement of what was done before. I think certainly it's a recommitment to what was done before, but it's also a recognition of a much different environment. Some of the players that we're talking about, some of the technologies we're talking about, I don't think anyone envisioned back in the late 80s, early 90s. What the government needs access to is non-traditional vendors in the marketplace. And there have been studies that have been done over the last several years about this, one out of Maryland, that talk to trying to access those people and having those people access this market so that the government can benefit from these cutting-edge technologies. The DoD's strength, to a great extent, is its ability to innovate and access innovation. And if we don't do something to allow that access to take place, again, we put ourselves at risk. So it overstates it to say it's simply a restatement of what we did before, like we really meant it. I'm sure that there's a component there, but it's also a recognition of a changed environment.
Right. Okay. Thanks, guys. And we do have to take our next break. When we come back, we'll be talking more to Tom Sisti. He is the Senior Director and Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP America, and John Etherton. John is the President of Etherton & Associates. And when we come back, we'll finish up on the NDAs and start talking about Better Buying 3.0. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guests are John Etherton. He's president of Etherton Associates, and Tom Sisti. He is the senior director and chief legislative counsel for SAP America, Inc. And guys, I know there's an area that we wanted to touch on with regard to the NDAAs, and that's acquisition workforce and what's going on in that space, John. So. What kind of provisions are there?
Well, I think both the House and Senate Armed Services Committees really need to be commended because of their understanding of the importance of people in the process and their efforts to try to improve the resources and the planning for the both human capital planning as well as to provide the funding for recruitment, retention, and education, primarily through the Defense Acquisition Workforce Development Fund. That fund was started up a few years ago. It was set to expire at the end of 2017. Both committees have basically set up a process that would extend the fund beyond that point. In the House case, they would make it permanent. Also to credit $500 million a year to the fund for use, which would really significantly increase the funding that would be available for that. And so that combined with some of the other more positive things in there for more opportunities for exchange programs, different educational opportunities, recognition for different types of service for both the civilian and the military acquisition workforce people, I think is very significant in both bills, and I think needs to be recognized as such.
Right. Okay. Thanks, John. Tom, any other final comments on the NDA? We need to look at a couple other provisions.
Well, I just, John... He says many, many great things, but he said one thing that just resonates with me today, that we seem to be coming back to these points in time where we're looking at the system again, and we come to a decision to make a process change. I think we have to be cautious in this respect. It's not only about process. We have to identify the why, and John said it best, something may not be addressed in all of these process reforms. And before we start looking at just changing the process again, we need to make sure we understand why we're at the point we are.
Right.
With respect to some of these provisions.
Right, it's more like rather than passing some legislation that mandates a particular a behavior or investment strategy or whatever, or a commercial activity in a particular way when you're dealing with federal procurement, understanding why people aren't doing what you want them to do or everybody sort of thinks would be a good thing for them to do, why they're not understanding the underlying causes would probably be the most logical first step to trying to figure out what to do to get people to do it without having to mandate it, right? Does that make sense?
And so, also not assuming that everything can be reduced, every procurement can be reduced to a common template. You are focusing on mission needs. There are things that contribute to the development of requirements, the mission of the agency, the activity involved, the location, all sorts of things go into that. And sometimes they don't fit neatly into a template.
Right. So, John, Better Buying 3.0, your thoughts?
Well, it
sounds like Larry King there, right?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting document. It clearly reflects sort of the evolution of thinking on acquisition in the department. And what the concerns that sort of arise as you look at better buying power, the original, then 2.0, then 3.0, you see a number of different things sort of emerging. I think the clear statement in better buying power 3.0 is we're very great concern about innovation and how do we keep innovation on track, counter some of the things that folks see vis-a-vis our potential adversaries in the world, and then combine that with a greater focus on cybersecurity, which really, interestingly, was not a big feature of the drafts that were circulated, but it's really come, you know, to become much more important as we got to the final version. So it's just kind of an interesting, you know, a lot of issues that have been sort of quiet for a long time. For example, independent research and development, how you effectively manage that and incentivize companies to do the right kinds of research with that funding. A number of other things that are now sort of back on the table, and I think, and which have not been for a while, and I think, again, will be an interesting conversation to sort of see where we end up, you know, with some of those issues. I think in the other areas, there's a lot of the right words about trying to do more with commercial items, interacting more with the commercial marketplace. I think a lot of what you see in better buying power, some is sort of consistent with what Dr. Carter was trying to do out in Silicon Valley a couple weeks ago, and which came out about this, occurred right about the same time as Better Buying Power 3.0 was released. So, but I think the innovation undercurrent, I guess, is sort of what I see as the biggest message that makes this one more distinctive in some ways than some of the earlier ones.
So what is the biggest hurdle to this innovation? Is it the intellectual property right? You know, is it what?
I think it's a very difficult set of issues. I mean, I think in some ways it comes down to basic funding. I think it's also how the industry is reading the demand signals from the Department of Defense. I think it's the degree to which the department is sort of managing for maybe a longer term time frame than a shorter term time frame. We've had a lot of conversations, and again, looking at the first better buying power was a lot about cutting costs. The common comment that I heard from many in the department was things cost too much, and so that was really about how do we cut the costs for the things that we buy. Well, if that is your priority, then that's a demand signal that you're sending to industry. Industry is then going to say, well, in order to improve my position with my customer, I'm going to channel money into cutting costs for maybe, you know, more in the near term for the things that we sell to the department, and you're going to see investments sort of flowing in that area. Now we're moving to a model which says, no, we really need to spend more time and effort and money on longer-term kinds of things. And so, but again, I think a lot of it has to do with the demand signals and what the priorities are and as how we've evolved our view of the acquisition process and what we want it to do over time.
Tom?
I also think part of it is you're dealing with a different supplier base. There are some people who are who weren't in this position to participate in the marketplace 20 and 30 years ago. We have all grown up in this system. We understand it. We understand it's a very rule-based, compliance-based system. The newer entrants in this marketplace, and I say this with love, may look at this and say, what is this? You know, we don't have to deal with this in the commercial space. What is this? I have to file this or certify to that. So I think it's almost a clash between cultures, if you will, a culture that's very much globally based in the commercial marketplace, trying to rationalize its participation in a rule-based system.
Right. But to me, it strikes me as someone, you know, I worked for the government 20 years. I understand the government, one of the biggest failings it has, John, it goes right back to requirements development and being able to articulate what you really need, what's going to, and actually measuring the success of that. Did it really meet the requirements or was it, you know, was the actual customer satisfaction there and what the requirements were? And to the extent the government's doing things to try to do better in the requirements definition, I think that's a good thing. The issue is that, and you've touched on it a little bit, is like at what point, philosophically, what is the government in the business to do? Is it in the business to build things like websites itself with its government employees, or is that something that's better left to the private market? And I think that's part of that gray area, what's really going on there. But we do have to take our next break, gentlemen. Want to come back, you know, if there's any other thoughts on Better Buying 3.0, we'll talk a little bit about OFP, category management and management procurement management initiatives. My guests today are John Etherton. He is president of Etherton & Associates, and Tom Sisti. He is the senior director and chief legislative counsel for SAP America. And you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guests are Tom Sisti. He is the senior director and chief legislative counsel at SAP America, and John Etherton, the president of Etherton & Associates. And John, you know, you touched on better, it's the last question, I think, better buying 3.0. But, you know, it strikes me, and I think you would agree, but I'll let you answer the question, is that this is like trying to turn an ocean liner. In the last segment, you talked about the message was, we got to cut costs. We got to cut costs. We're, you know, dialing down. We're ending conflict and budgets are going down. Now, all of a sudden, it's flipped and say, we need to invest. We need to invest collectively in the future to maintain, technological superiority. This is a big deal in the change and what it means for the market. And it's not something that's going to happen quickly. I mean, there's got to be more than words, right? I mean, actions speak louder than words.
Well, and I also don't think that folks are endorsing the idea that things now can cost more either.
Right, yeah, absolutely, right. Can't have it both ways, right?
That's still an imperative that, yeah. You know, is we're laboring under the Budget Control Act caps, and even if there are some relief is given around some of the edges of that, it's still a major concern, and the cost of the process is still a major concern. So you have a lot of competing things, but I do think that there is a sense that the innovation, you know, issue is becoming more and more imperative and more of a critical issue. But I think the challenge is, how do we have many varieties of cake and eat them all too, yeah. You know, and trying to sort of work this. So I think if you read Better Buying Power 3.0, it seems like in some sense, occasionally you'll see things that seem to be cutting across each other in terms of the directions that folks want to go. And, you know, what's your approach to innovation? On the one hand, you want to have a more of an open process where you can have collaborative sort of partnerships. And on the other hand, if you look at some of the language, say, around the independent research and development portion, there is definitely an undercurrent that says we need to regulate this more as a way of getting more value out of the money that we're currently spending on innovation. As I said, I think there are just a number of different layers and currents here that have to be, and you have to have all of these things in play, but I think reconciling them satisfactorily and balancing them is going to be a real challenge.
Right. Okay, so let's turn to the OFPP, some of their initiatives, and some of the language around category management as a management philosophy, I guess, or imperative that's being implemented across the government right now, at least in a procurement context, and what it does or doesn't mean for companies. And particularly, Tom, you know, one of the things that we've started to hear, I don't know if directly, is whether it's a criticism or an observation about the 1990s and the reform effort there, sort of opening the door to contract duplication and this explosion, in particular, of IT contracts, you know, perhaps as a result of the repeal of the Brooks Act and the, you know, central sort of procurement authority. You know, do you have thoughts on that direction and sort of the idea right now, too, they're looking at revising the business case analysis process to maybe put some more, quote, teeth into it? I don't know how they do that, but that's what they're looking at.
Well, I think that OFPP deserves a lot of credit, especially for the December memo coming out and attempting to tackle this issue. It is an enormous issue. The idea that they want to drive simplification, they want to leverage data, they want to collaborate with industry and bring in new non-traditional players into the environment and help them. They want to mitigate unnecessary contract duplication. I mean, these are all very laudable goals. I think the devil's in the details. And maybe I'm the only one that doesn't know this, but I still can't get my mind around category management, what it means, because I'm trying to understand the definition, how it differs from what we do, say, over a GSA on schedules, you know, with the various schedule categories, what's the difference. I understand the procedurally, intellectually, I could read it and comprehend the intent. I'm not sure where we're going with it, but that's me. You know, I mean, it might be helpful to understand a little bit more of that. I think with respect to the references of unintended consequences, the whole nature of the changes really is complex from the 1990s. When you look at FASA, first of all, the Brooks Act repeal wasn't FASA, it was Clinger-Cohen.
Right.
The motivations for that were multifarious. You had, I don't think there was this notion that people didn't want things centralized in GSA as much as there was a desire to vest acquisition officials with discretion to empower those people to make decisions that affected them because they were closest to the transaction. So it wasn't like necessarily a broad philosophical divide on central versus decentral. And why is that distinction important? Because if we are not focusing on what I think John has talked about in the past, this notion of identifying the why state, why are we in this state? And we say, well, it's a process issue without really being specific, then we are doomed to another round of procurement Groundhog Day, changing the process, and several years later, whether it's a decade or two, coming to the same point where we go, gosh, we're back here again, and we need another bill to change the process. It's important to, I think, have an element of specificity around those changes and to identify the real problem, because I don't think it was necessarily a centralization versus decentralization issue. And you can even look at some of the things that were done earlier. CECO was, in part, an effort to try and centralize the federal acquisition regulation, right? We had multiple regulatory processes there.
Right, different regimes. You still do.
Yeah, we do, but
why is that, John? No.
Well, but that's the point, right? Why does that happen? I don't think it was as bright a distinction as that.
Right. Well, even in Kleiner Cohen, there is the IT GWAC authority, right? That mm-hmm. OMB that OFPP OMB has to designate executive agents for the government-wide acquisition of information technology, a management tool that I think hasn't, in terms of focusing agencies to utilize those vehicles, the power of that hasn't really, I think, ever been fully utilized as a management tool by OMB.
But the Form 300 process, again, that's not a decentralization versus centralization issue. It was a process where everybody was supposed to submit their business case and then would vet it for that, that reason. I think that what we're confronting is just trying to understand why we've hit this point again, where we're still wrestling over commercial items, we're still wrestling over simplification, we're still wrestling over a compliance-driven environment that reduces people to checklisting as they go through these compliance requirements and not necessarily leveraging our people efficiently.
Right. John, do you have any thoughts?
My thought is, a lot of this really, and especially when we get into the conversation on commercial item acquisition, is one of the fundamental issues that we have been struggling with as long as I've been involved in this issue for, the last 30 years or so, is this whole issue of measuring value. Hmm. What does, how do you measure value in a way that, is it at the transaction level, which is kind of where I see us primarily measuring it now? I think that's the yardstick that my sense is that the oversight communities use when they judge the quality of an acquisition decision or whatever. They tend to measure it at the transaction by transaction level. And how do we sort of come up with different ways of looking at value, which make the system more open to, say, different private sector ways of measuring value? It seems like we're in the private sector, we have this proliferation of value propositions, that just are ongoing. I mean, in the consumer area, look at all the different ways you're being sold services or products or anything else. Mm-hmm. And the government's process for measuring value is relatively narrow, both in terms of what different elements are considered in terms of making the determination and the period of time over which you make that determination, and is that compatible with innovation, some of these other things that we're really trying to address, and how do you do it in a way that can assure your average citizen or even very knowledgeable people that taxpayer dollars are being spent well, and that we're exercising good stewardship over this relatively small amount of money that we have as we go forward. It's a lot of money, but it's certainly not this expanding pie that people have experienced in the past. So, I mean, to me, that's really the fundamental issue: is how do we measure value? How do we understand what it means? How do we demonstrate that we're getting the maximum value for the money that we're spending in the federal government, absent some of the private sector metrics like profit and loss and things like that, which make it, I think, much easier to trace and make the accountability problem a lot simpler as well. And I think that in the past we've come up with the idea that if we follow certain
rules,
process requirements and rules, right, that will get you close to that,
right,
as. And I'm not sure that model is the sustainable model going into the future, but I don't know what emerges to replace it.
And along those lines, the implications of what John's saying are that industry has to accept this cannot be a mirror image of the commercial marketplace because there are other drivers. You talked about, John, in the NDIA study, the boundary constraints that drive the acquisition system. Well, you know, one of them is that you're dealing with the public fisc, and
right,
you have to,
mm-hmm,
safeguard that in a way. We don't have shareholder meetings, you know. We don't have...
Those are called elections.
Right, my guess. But how many people have those reduced, the procurement issues reduced down to election issues? Not many.
Right, right.
Not many. And so there isn't that direct management on that level the way it exists in the private sector. So industry has to bend a little too and recognize that there are drivers in the government space that have to be respected.
Right. And we have to, I'm sorry, guys, we have to end the show. I want to thank my guest today, John Etherton. He is the president of Etherton Associates, and Tom Sisti, who is a senior director and chief legislative counsel for SAP America. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.